stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The death toll from Ecuador's biggest earthquake in decades has soared to at least 233 Sunday, as rescuers using tractors and bare hands hunting desperately for survivors in shattered coastal towns. The 7.8 magnitude quake struck off the Pacific coast Saturday and was felt around the nation of 16 million people. It caused panic as far away as the capital of Quito and collapsing buildings and roads in a swath of western towns. President Rafael Correa, who was rushing home from a trip to Italy, had confirmed the number of fatalities rose Sunday to 233. Meanwhile, the country's vice president says the quake has caused considerable damage. He says citizens under the supervision of emergency personnel are being moved, and this is taking place in an orderly fashion. We're asking everyone to remain calm. More than 1,500 people are injured, according to authorities. Meanwhile, 11 people remain missing Sunday in southern Japan from two powerful earthquakes there that killed 41 people. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has announced that it's preparing to join relief efforts, and Toyota said it would suspend nearly all vehicle production in Japan. Major oil producers began talks in Qatar Sunday, trying to reach a deal on capping production to boost prices, even though Iran was absent from the talks. Talks were delayed by several hours after some countries demanded changes to a draft agreement that calls for freezing production until October. This is VOA News. A Burundi official said Sunday that four members of the country's ruling party were killed in an attack and continuing violence associated with the extended tenure of President Pierre Nkurunziza. The attack was on supporters of the ruling party who had gathered for an environmental cleanup exercises, according to the chief of Mungamba District in Bururi Province. The four men died after armed men dressed in hoods and military fatigues stormed a bar Saturday night and opened fire. That's according to a survivor of that attack. Conditions are desperate inside a Palestinian refugee camp. It's home to 10,000 civilians in Damascus, according to the United Nations Sunday. It comes as civilian casualties mount elsewhere from indiscriminate attacks across the country, despite a nominal ceasefire. The UN Palestinian Refugee Agency said violent battles between extremists have left residents of the Yarmouk camp without food or water for more than a week. Meanwhile, Pope Francis took some Syrian refugees back to Rome after a quick visit to the Greek island of Lesbos, where refugees have been living in camps. Hassan was one of the refugees.
Thank you for all. We appreciate your prayers for all refugees, especially for Syrian refugees.
The Vatican confirmed that the three Muslim families, including six children, will be housed in the Vatican. Pope Francis said his decision to bring them back to Rome was purely humanitarian and not a political act. U.S. Defense Chief Ash Carter has compared the Islamic State to cancer and said the insurgent group must be destroyed in Iraq and Syria because that's the whole thing arose.
And we need to destroy it there so it'll become clear to everybody that there can't be a state. There isn't going to be a state based on this ideology.
Carter spoke during a visit to the United Arab Emirates as part of an effort to get Gulf nations to help Iraq as it fights the Islamic State. French President François Hollande has arrived in Egypt on a visit that hosts say will deepen the distinct and strong ties the two nations share, but say it's also taking place while Egypt's image in Europe is being battered over the case of an Italian graduate student kidnapped and tortured to death in Cairo. Italy said Sunday that it hoped Libya's UN-backed unity government could restore control of the country's borders to limit migrant flows from north and south and was ready to help in any way it could. The French and German foreign ministers visited Tripoli on Saturday to show support for the government. More details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The first event will be his wearing in ceremony for him to take up his position as first vice president. In the next day or two, the government of national unity will be formed.
The South Sudanese rebel leader, Dr. Riek Machar, is expected in the capital, Juba, Monday.
The bishop's concern was that from the last election, we have had senior commissioners mentioned in advancing investigations elsewhere in the world, actually in Britain, and several senior staff being sent home. So the feeling of the bishop was that we need to strengthen the IEBC.
The Kenyan Conference of Catholic Bishops expresses concern about corruption in public institutions, including the Electoral Commission.
But reality is the spending is already so low that 4% growth, while it's an increase and it means more resources for health, especially in the low-income settings, it still means a significant gap.
And global health economists say funding for healthcare services around the world is getting harder to find. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The leader of the South Sudanese rebels, Dr. Riek Machar, is expected in Juba Monday to take up his position as the first vice president in a soon-to-be-formed transitional unity government. His arrival forms part of the peace accord signed between him and President Salva Kiir last year to end the country's conflict. James Gadget Dak, spokesman for Riek Machar, told me the rebels are committed towards the full implementation of the peace agreement.
Chief of General Staff of the SCLA-IO is supposed to arrive today in Juba to prepare the ground for the reception of the first vice president. He will arrive tomorrow and hopefully he will be sworn in as first vice president.
What's next after he arrives tomorrow, Monday? Because his arrival has been postponed a few times. Now it's certain that he will arrive tomorrow. When he arrives, what happens next?
The first event will be his wearing-in ceremony for him to take up his position as first vice president. And hopefully, in the next day or two, the government of national unity will be formed, which will include 10 ministerial positions or ministers, cabinet ministers from his side, and 16 from the government of President Salva Kiir. In addition to four more ministers from the other political parties and former detainees. So the cabinet will be composed of 30 ministers. This will run the government for the next 30 months until elections are conducted.
We heard reports that some people are being prevented from going to welcome Dr. Riek Machar at the airport. What can you tell me about this?
This is another unfortunate situation because the government, first of all, has refused a public rally to be jointly conducted by the first vice president and President Salva Kiir, which we thought was necessary and important because upon his arrival, the citizens of South Sudan or the people of South Sudan should be reassured that the peace agreement is on course. Unfortunately, the government has refused this. Also, the government has refused to let the public to go to the airport to receive him. They just told them to stay indoors for secure reasons, which they could not explain which secure reasons. This is another concern. So there will be no people to go to the airport to receive him. Only the government officials and some officials from the SLMIO will be allowed to go to the airport.
One of the critical demands of the SPLMIO is of the 28 states that you said was unilaterally established by President Kiir. He said he's not going to change his mind because that is what the people of South Sudan want and he's giving to them.
Well, according to the IGAD communique, which came out at the end of January, like 3 months ago, it was very clear that the 28 states be suspended and a boundary commission be formed by the unity government, which will be formed, so that they try to tackle the fate of the 28 states and agree on a number of new states, since they have agreed in principle to increase the number of states. You remember that during the peace talks, the SPLM-IO proposed that the country should be restructured into 21 states, which are based on the former colonial district, which have their boundaries intact. Unfortunately, the government refused, although the SPLM-IO at that time was arguing that this has been a popular demand of the people for decades. The government refused. They did not recognize that it was a popular demand of the people until the peace agreement was signed based on the current 10 states. And after the signing of the peace agreement, 2 months later, they came up with 28 states, claiming that it is a popular demand of the people. So this is an unfortunate situation, which will actually maybe lead to non-cooperation within the new unity government. But we hope that with formation of establishment of boundary commission, the parties may agree on a new new number of states to be created. And if they cannot agree, then the IGAD communique is clear that they revert to the 10 states.
James Gadget Dak is the spokesman for the South Sudanese rebel leader, Dr. Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the King and capital, Nairobi. Meanwhile, South Sudan is holding a Wrestling for Peace tournament, bringing together athletes from around the country. The last big tournament was cancelled when civil war broke out in December 2013. For VOA, Jason Pattinking reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
With chests bare and leopard skins tied around their waists, 30 South Sudanese wrestlers marched into Juba Stadium Saturday morning. Traditional wrestling is hugely popular here. Four teams from different tribes will compete in the tournament to bring home prizes of cattle and national bragging rights. The tournament is also about showing that different South Sudanese tribes can bring peace after more than 2 years of war divided the country along ethnic lines. Peter Biarajak, CEO of South Sudan Wrestling Entertainment, which organized the event, said South Sudan's leaders have been too slow to end the civil war. He says it is time ordinary folks did so themselves through sport.
So we felt the people of South Sudan need peace, and we start mobilizing as young people from different tribes that we are going to host a wrestling tournament as a way of, as our own way of bringing peace to South Sudan, a peace at grassroots level.
Ajak says the last wrestling tournament in Juba began on December 14th, 2013, one day before war broke out.
But it was very sad that people came to Juba to promote peace, to promote their culture, to promote peaceful coexistence, and then they were interrupted by a conflict. So this morning I was very excited when we managed to go ahead with the, to start the tournament and to start the match, and I'm glad that this match has happened successfully and peacefully.
In Saturday's match, the Bor Dinka tribe defeated the Mundari after 15 rounds. The two tribes have a history of deadly conflict over pasture and cattle. Bor Dinka coach Chol Jock said bringing young men of the two tribes together to wrestle can prevent violence.
When we are wrestling with somebody, and then you go and dance with him, eat with him, this one will be your friend. And then you sit together and then you play everything with him, and then there's no fighting again.
Bor Dinka wrestler Manyak Mapel Luau said he felt happy to wrestle after so long.
You know, seeing the war break out in 2013, we are facing difficulties. And when we come to an end, we shall be happy. So we want to show to the people that we accepted the feast.
The tournament will last 1 week. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
The The Kenyan Conference of Catholic Bishops has expressed concern about corruption in the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC. The priests also encouraged dialogue between the IEBC and all other electoral stakeholders to resolve their concerns before next year's polls. David Omwoyo, Director of Communications at the Kenya Conference of Catholic Bishops, told me Kenyans have praised the strong stance taken by the priests against corruption in the East African country.
The concerns really are about the capacity of the IEBC to hold free and fair elections. The bishop's concern was that from the last election, we have had senior commissioners mentioned in adversely in ongoing investigations elsewhere in the world, actually in Britain, and several senior staff being sent home. So the feeling of the bishops was that we need to strengthen the IEBC and, if need be, reconstituted. They did not say that clearly, but they said that the issues about the capacity of our IEBC are very clear. We cannot just throw them on the carpet. We need to address them so that we have a strong, credible institution, especially in a country where we have issues of major elections being contested. It is important that the organization or the institution that oversees such elections is an institution that has its credibility and dented, so that then we can have the assurance of all the parties involved that they believe or trust in the capacity of the institution.
Does that mean that Kenyans are looking at the IEBC with suspicion, particularly when it comes to issues of corruption that they said permeate government or public institutions?
Bishops were saying now, therefore, let us not ignore these stakeholders in the electoral process of the country. If one party or more than one political party has issues with the electoral body in a country, we do not just ignore it.
I've heard some politicians call for the disbandment of the IEBC or the reconstitution of the IEBC, and they have also expressed concern about the prevailing conditions on the ground ahead of the elections, which they fear could cause election violence if not properly addressed. Did the Catholic bishops talk about these issues as well?
Yes, actually, well, the bishops said they have heard, like as you said, that certain politicians and very senior politicians for that matter have expressed their concerns about the conduct or the capacity of IEBC. Other politicians have also dismissed such feelings and reaffirmed their trust in IEBC. What the bishop said is that that is not the way to handle a contest about the capacity of the electoral body in a country. They say that everybody who is a stakeholder in the elections should come to a round table, and then we put politics aside and discuss it. So basically, while some politicians have said and they have cited examples about maybe the conduct of certain by-elections or mini-elections and said that for this and this reason, IEBC cannot do these elections, others have said that, no, we are sure that IEBC is okay. Whoever wants to respond, it is only being political. What the bishop said is that all these parties who have issues can we sit down and discuss with the sole objective of getting a credible electoral body which will deliver credible election results to avoid a contestation of their results, because anytime any post-election violence and whatever is issued about a contested result, And one of the main factors that causes a contested result is the credibility of the electoral body. So the bishop said, please listen to everybody, the stakeholders. Let's see what they say. Let's hear, apart from accusing the electoral body, let them give us suggestions, that the other people, the government side, and they ask the parliament actually to do something, the judiciary and all that, so that then we have a credible body. Because by getting a credible body that is overseeing the elections, you are reducing the chances of having a contested election, so that when the results of the elections are announced, all the parties are satisfied that we know the body that oversaw the election. Therefore, we have no doubt.
How are Kenyans reacting to this message from the Catholic bishops concerning the IEBC so far? Because I heard on the social media platforms, there have been a lot of chatter.
One thing that is coming out from the social media is that this is perhaps the boldest statement by the Catholic bishops in more than 10 years, where they came out and they were very bold in their assessment of the situation of the country. What I have seen in my own assessment was that Kenyans getting very optimistic and saying, at last, the church has taken the position, the church has come out boldly for the first time in several years, the church has come out boldly, state matters that have been disturbing us and all that. We have to note that the reason why there is a lot of excitement about the bishop's statement is not because these matters are not being mentioned here and there, is that the Catholic Church is a credible institution, and therefore it's also an institution that cannot be intimidated by state machinery. So when Catholic bishops come out and mention that, considering that they represent 33% of the entire populace, then they are able to be taken more seriously. So for the Kenyans, what I saw basically was about the excitement that the church has come out in more than 10 years, for the first time in more than 10 years, the church has come out to explicitly state and take a position that they are on the side of Kenyans, not on the side of the political class or the government. So that has been so far, and because I interact a lot with social media, that has been the reaction that has come out so far.
David Omuonyo is the Director of Communications at the Kenyan Conference of Catholic Bishops. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. Zimbabweans in the Chinoy District, Mashonaland West Province, say President Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party is unlikely to resolve the country's land issue. This as there is alleged corruption in the grabbing of white-owned commercial lands when the program was introduced in 2000. The villagers are now demanding a land audit and the redistribution of farms currently in the hands of new black farmers. For VOA, Arthur Chigoriwa reports from the provincial capital, Chinoy.
Some lucky ones who benefited under the ZANU-PF championed land reforms in 2000 are now multiple farm owners. They forcibly took over land owned by white commercial farmers. Urungwe farmer Panashe Mtundusha, who is a pending land ownership Rengo case in Chinoy courts over the land allocation of two tree farms, says indications are that the land issue won't be resolved anytime soon in Zimbabwe.
Unfortunate that 36 years down the line, the land issue has not been resolved at all. And it's not the ZANU-PF government that is in a position to resolve the issue, since it has benefited from the improper redistribution of the land. Its officials have benefited from having multiple farms. It is the next government that is supposed to resolve the issue, but not the ZANU-PF government. It has failed.
He believes that people with multiple farms should surrender them to landless peasants.
We need a proper land audit. It's the only way to go. Those who have many farms, some of those farms should be taken and given to other people. And those who have farms which are bigger than the recommended maximum farm size, they should be cut, left with the proper sizes which conform to the constitution of Zimbabwe.
Mangura villager Onismo Tagarika supports such moves, adding that Zimbabwe should conduct a land audit that should result in the redistribution of land to some communal farmers, including women and the youth.
I think the land issue should be resolved by undertaking another land audit, whereby we are looking at blacks who are having large tracts of land while other blacks are still landless. For example, in Kariba, I find people were displaced by the construction of the Kariba Dam, and they're still landless up to this day. There's no rationale to say the land issue has been resolved.
Melody Chinowaita of Chinoya agrees, noting that the redistribution of land would play a critical role in addressing drought and other issues related to food insecurity. Chinowaita says women should benefit from a fresh land program.
We are left out with no land during the 2000 land reform exercise. Next time, more women should be allocated land if we are to minimize hunger in the country, because women till the land more than men.
A young Chinoy resident, Mishek Rangwani, says there are few people of his age group who were allocated land under the present agrarian reforms.
For the land reform, you'd realize that there is a national youth policy that was set aside. And that policy said 25% of every other resource that can be indigenized has to be given to the youth. But if you go on the ground, you'll find the land reform came, And if you are going to do head count, you realize that not even 10% of the youths had access to land. So from my own perspective, I think the government is not incorporating youths.
But ZANU-PF member Clifford Kupeko, a beneficiary of land reform, says all those who wanted land were given by ZANU-PF government and most people are happy.
So land is very, very critical. And I'm glad to say, having elected Mugabe in 1980, riding on the promise that he is going to redistribute land to people, he has scored on that one. And the majority of people now own pieces of land. Everyone is happy about the land issue.
Some political analysts argue that it is likely that there will be another land revolution in Zimbabwe in the near future, targeted at multiple farm owners. This is Arthur Chigoriwa.
Global health economists say funding for healthcare services around the world is getting harder and harder to find. The lack of funding is a real threat for people around the world struggling with some of the world's most deadly health issues. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
People wasting away from AIDS or succumbing to malaria may become an increasingly common sight within the next 25 years, as funding for universal healthcare shrivels up. That bleak assessment is suggested in two new reports by Joseph Dielman, an economist at the Institute for Medical Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle, Washington, published in the journal The Lancet. Experts say poor countries are not keeping up funding necessary for universal health care at the same time that international aid continues to stagnate. Currently, donor governments and organizations provide $36 billion a year on health care, according to Dielman, an amount that's continuing to grow but not keeping up to meet health care demand. The same is true with spending by low-income countries themselves, which is rising by 4%.
But reality is the spending is already so low that that 4% growth, while it's a increase and it means more resources for health, especially in the low-income settings, it still means a significant gap.
The researchers used previous research that estimated the cost of health care per person in low-income countries would be about $86 per person. Dielman says the poorest countries may fall short of the $86 per person in health care spending projected to be required for essential services in 2040. The crisis could affect 35 low and moderate income countries, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa, that carry the greatest burden of disease. An analysis of 184 countries by Dielman and colleagues found that 15 million people who are taking antiretroviral therapy for HIV/AIDS could be impacted by a shortfall in healthcare dollars. For example, Dielman says funding for HIV treatment went up substantially between 2000 and 2009 by 24% yearly.
So remarkable growth, but more recently that 24% annualized growth rate has shrunk down to 1%. So a drastic reduction in the amount of resource and how much is growing.
According to research estimates, the average healthcare spending per person will range from $164 in low-income countries to more than $9,000 in wealthier nations. Annual healthcare spending is projected to be the highest in the U.S. at more than $16,000 per person. In 25 years, the least amount of healthcare money could be available in Somalia at only $34 per capita. One solution, according to experts, is for countries to increase tax collection on wealthier citizens and give a lower priority to programs like fuel subsidies. An assessment of future public health spending was presented this week at a World Bank meeting on universal health care. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, South Africa's men's and women's teams will both play host Brazil in the group stage of the 2016 Olympics. The men have been drawn in Group A along with Iraq and Denmark. The women are in Group E with China and Sweden. Brazil's men were runners-up in 2012, the women's runners-up in 2008. Both teams are expected to be tough opponents in their home country. 58 matches, 32 for the men, 26 for the women, will be played in the tournament from August 3rd to 20th. Here is the full draw for the Olympic football tournament Rio 2016. For men, in Group A is Brazil, South Africa, Iraq and Denmark. Group B is Sweden, Colombia, Nigeria and Japan. Group C is Fiji, Korean Republic, Mexico and Germany. Group D is Portugal, Honduras, Algeria and Argentina. And for the women, Group E is Brazil, China, Sweden and South Africa. Group F is Canada, Zimbabwe, Australia and Germany. And Group G is USA, New Zealand, France and Colombia. Still talking of Rio 2016, when the Ethiopian selectors decide on their Olympic marathon teams for Rio, the names of Tesfaye Abera and Mezeleki Malikamu are very likely to be in their thoughts after their double triumph at the Hamburg Marathon on Sunday. For VOA, the energetic Andy Edwards reports from Hamburg on two outstanding performances.
One is a seasoned competitor, the other relatively new to the world scene. Or the more experienced performer, Mezelek Melkamu, once again proves she can battle the elements as well as run fast and beat her rivals. She said before the race how motivated she was to qualify for the Olympic team for Ethiopia in the marathon, and her commitment could not be faulted. Melkamu took more than 2 minutes off the course record to run 2 hours, 21 minutes and 54 seconds. That was almost within a minute of her lifetime best. Now, taking into account the strong wind that made life tough for the runners in the second half of the race, it was a perfect reminder of her ability to the Ethiopian selectors. Last year's women's champion, Nezret Haylu, also performed creditably to finish second, but almost 6 minutes behind her compatriot. A big talking point in this North German city was the performance of the local runner, Anya Schell, who finished third, beating a stack of better-known performers and running well inside the national Olympic qualifying time with 2 hours, 27 minutes, 50. Tesfaye Abera scored his second big win of the year in very different conditions to those of Dubai in late January. Hamburg presented its variable weather conditions, sunshine then sharp winds, which tested even the elite. The men's lead pack offered a contrast in height, with the contest coming down to a duel between the lanky Abera, one of the tallest marathon runners in the world, and the diminutive Kenyan policeman, Philemon Rono. The latter had finished third and fourth in previous Hamburg races and improved in the latest edition as well, but not enough to deny the Ethiopian. Tesfaye Abera won in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 58 seconds, almost half a minute clear of Rono, with another Kenyan, Josephat Kiprono, almost 4 minutes adrift of the winner. Ethiopian selectors for the Olympic marathon have a big field of choice as ever, and the spring marathon season still has a week to run. But the performances of Tesfaye Abera and Mezelek Melkamu should win some solid votes. This is Andy Edwards for VOA in Hamburg.
And that report by Andy Edwards brings us to the end of this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. A It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect at Flashback with music from the continent.
Kennedy Ganjo, great community leader. on me again. girl, you make my head spin. The way you do your boom boom dance make me wanna do you, girl. You've got a killer body, AK-47. Oh girl, you are naughty. Everybody watch your body. The way you go down, you make me wanna call you honey. The way you go down, you make me wanna spend my money. The way you go down, you make me wanna call you honey. The way you go down, you make me wanna spend my money. Let's go to the boom boom room and do that boom boom dance.
Pretty lady's body's really hot, so hotter than cold. Cold. She got me screaming, girl, you don't need to be told. By now, gosh, like a C4 ready to explode. Better hold your man, then cross any man, see her with her love down low. She be the most wanted whenever she go down low. I feel so anointed, oh no, let me care about gold.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week marked the second anniversary of the kidnapping of the over 200 Chibok girls. Since then, efforts have been made by two governments of Nigeria to rescue them. It has been a formidable task. The reason being that we are dealing with a brutal, cynical terrorist group, Boko Haram. But it is good that the international community is now refocusing its attention on the Chibok girls. Last week, UNICEF issued a very serious report. It disclosed that Boko Haram has escalated its gruesome practice of sending girls as young as 13 and 15 on suicide missions in crowded marketplaces. It is not an easy task to prevent such gruesome action, even with the best intentions. Last week also, there was some glimmer of hope when the U.S. news network CNN showed video of 15 of the Chibok girls. Family members who saw the video confirmed that indeed they were the Chibok girls. But then it was said, and that is doubtful, that those 15 disclosures may mean that the Chibok girls are all alive and well. It should be recalled that shortly after they were kidnapped and the government began a campaign to rescue them, it was assumed, and correctly, that Boko Haram may have split the girls in very small groups and placed them in different locations. It is therefore possible that what was shown on CNN was just one group in one location. Much more should be done to demand from Boko Haram some evidence that all the Chibok girls are alive and well. Nevertheless, since the new government of Nigeria, Buhari, military efforts have been made to push back Boko Haram in the northeast. The army has recaptured much territory from Boko Haram, and they are now confined to a small area. Former President Obasanjo recently paid a visit to the northeast, and he confirmed that indeed the military had made much progress and Boko Haram is now confined to a small area. But he understood and acknowledged that much needs to be done to support the people of the northeast to have better security. Now, what next to be done? There is a danger that there might be a split between the parents and relatives of the Chibok girl and the government of Nigeria. The frequent demonstrations in Abuja in front of the presidential palace is an indication of this danger. Perhaps the time has come for the government of Nigeria to accept the intervention of third parties in the rescue operation of the Chibok girls. For example, the African Union or the United Nations will be helpful. This will give some reassurance to the relatives and friends and Nigerians that indeed the government is doing everything possible for the rescue of these girls. It is sad indeed that since the kidnapping, some of the parents of these girls have passed away. And therefore, it is quite urgent that much more be done by the international community in assisting Nigeria for the rescue and return of the Chibok girls to the families. But it required some patience, because these operations that we have seen not only in Nigeria, but all over the world, that dealing with terrorist groups is extremely difficult, particularly those that are so cynical that could send young girls on suicide missions. So an appeal should be made to the parents and friends to exercise patience, even though I acknowledge that it's easy to say. I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jonah. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter and producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when spider webs unite, they can tie up a lion. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Africa Logistic Forum is an example of how the United States can support African nations to examine and explore continuing logistics challenges in Africa's security sector, said U.S. Ambassador to Ghana, Robert Jackson. Speaking at the opening ceremony of the Africa Logistics Forum in Accra, April 12th, the ambassador noted, "The forum focuses on analyzing the existing logistic gaps, explores practical applications, and surveys sound principles for effective logistics management." The United States, he said, continues to recognize the importance of the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center. The center's mission to provide training, education, and research to foster peace and stability in Africa is vital and has impact on real lives throughout Africa. The center has already trained more than 11,000 people from diverse organizations in essential aspects of peacekeeping operations. "The United States' main objective," said Ambassador Jackson, "is to support African nations with all required assistance. It is imperative to have experienced personnel with the right equipment and training if we are to overcome the logistical obstacles we face in garrison, operational, or tactical environments." "Our Ghanaian partners have been a major contributor to the United Nations peacekeeping operations," he said, "supplying more than 3,000 personnel, including police, military observers, and troops, in the past 8 years. Exercises such as the Logistics Peacekeeping Operations and the African Deployment Assistance Partnership Team, conducted in Ghana, Togo, and Benin in the last 2 years, have been essential for training logistical units and personnel. The Logistics Peacekeeping Operations is a training event focused on logistics before, during, and after peacekeeping operations. This exercise covered sustainment principles, including preventative maintenance checks and services, subsistence and field feeding, general supply, transportation, distribution, as well as logistical estimates. In addition, the African Deployment Assistance Partnership Team bridges the gap between limited deployment capacity to participating nations in peacekeeping operations, humanitarian response operations, and contingency operations." Ambassador Jackson told the forum participants that the United States and the nations of Africa share a common destiny. "I am confident," he said, "that work like yours will allow us to marshal the tools necessary to craft partnerships and, as Kofi Annan said, to face our goals together."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.